Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung.
Green high-rise or garden city?
Both and. In principle, we are always for both and. But I guess garden city being the more traditional city planning approach, maybe the green high-rise is the contemporary version of the garden city. So in that case, green high-rise.
Nature or technology?
Oh, another both and. This one for sure, and most definitely a both and. And funnily enough, actually, we speak very often in the context of our architecture about a both and approach, because we quite often actually bridge a gap or bridge two seemingly opposite requirements, or we bring them together or we kind of marry them in a solution that can then be quite unexpected. So most definitely, technology and nature, both, they go very well hand in hand.
Voluntary or regulation?
Ooh, very good one. I would hope for voluntary. The truth is, I think regulation might be needed at times. In many instances, I think it takes someone to start voluntarily and to set an example, set a precedent, and show that it's possible. And then regulation can follow suit to establish a new status quo.
In current debates, there are lots of discussions about climate-friendly, sustainable constructions. This has been practiced in Asia for many years already. On the one hand, considering the necessity to offer as many people as possible a satisfying home in a dense city environment. On the other hand, because it has been politically demanded and then even regulated by law. The Singapore-based studio Voha has focused on designing integrated architectural and urban planning solutions for 28 years now. To address 21st century issues such as climate change, population growth, and rapidly increasing urbanization. Today in our podcast, we, Diane Slavich and Katharina Patrice Varga, talk to Shirin Taras-Breinhold from Voha about what this involves in detail and where a simple rethinking can have a big effect.
Shirin, you studied architecture at the RWTH or RWTH Aachen and ETH Zurich. In 2005, you moved from your native country, Germany, to Singapore and have been with Voha ever since. From 2017 on, you are director and COO at Voha. Shirin, welcome to our podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into our topic for today, tell us what your tasks are at Voha and which projects you're currently working on.
I actually kind of work on all projects and therefore also on none. So I work basically in office administration. I work in business development. I make sure that the office runs. I make sure that we have sufficient staff. So I am pretty much involved in all running projects.
A few years ago, what we now discuss as a climate appropriate building, this was dismissed as tropical architecture, or a topic that only affected the megacities of the Southern Hemisphere. Today, the situation has changed completely, and it is considered as a worldwide relevance. Singapore has already been a pioneer in this respect a long time. Even with radical urban planning, what's different there, Shirin?
I think we've got to dissect this a tiny little bit because there are different elements to this. On one hand, there is tropicality and tropical architecture. And on the other hand, there are global questions of megacities and rapid urbanization and finding new ways of developing very large, very fast-growing cities. There is an overlap in the two, and that overlap is a particularly interesting spot, actually, because many, if not most, of the new megacities around the globe are actually situated in the tropical belt. And that is particularly challenging in some ways, because the existing typologies that we have in architecture and urban planning that were developed for high-density environments were not developed in the tropical climate. So traditional high-density typologies like the skyscraper that was developed for cities like Chicago or New York or Frankfurt are not necessarily the best solutions and not necessarily the best typologies to apply them blindly to the tropical context. So the two topics are interrelated to a certain extent, and the specific need for high density typologies that work well in the tropics, I think, is a particularly fascinating topic, because not only do we need to deal with the question of high density and how do we come up with typologies that, you know, accommodate a lot of amenity as well as high density in the same time, but we also need to question how these typologies work with a tropical climate, which by definition obviously has very, very different conditions, you know, temperatures always being high, humidity always being high. There's a huge need for new typologies and new solutions to be proposed.
Thinking about green facades and green spaces, we think that they aren't enough to save the whole world. The human scale is just as important, as well as the social scale, of course, and the strengthening of biodiversity, etc. What makes your prototype so effective?
Again, there's many aspects to this question. So like you say, green facades as one element are often referred to as an element of a more sustainable architecture. But the reality is they are the most visible element of it. I think if we're talking about the city of the future and not just sustainable, but regenerative city models for the future, we need to really look at fundamental changes in planning. And integrating greenery addresses many concerns, not all of them, but really acts on many levels. Human scale, for instance, greenery helps with that as well. It is also a question of structuring your buildings accordingly to accommodate a certain human scale. Greenery helps with that as well, but it equally helps with combating the urban heat island effect, lowering surface temperatures, filtering air quality, and many, many, many other aspects. So I think one really needs to look at the subject holistically. Ultimately, the question that we're dealing with is really the question about the city of the 21st century, so both present and future. The unique task, really, that we have at hand in our generation, that we simply need to accommodate far more people on the planet than we ever had before. And of those people, far more than ever live in cities. So it's a really all-encompassing task that we as architects and urban planners and, you know, scientists and politicians and, you know, really across all disciplines have to tackle. Ultimately, it kind of comes down to the question of civilization. How do we as a species in the 21st century, how do we want to live? How do we want to accommodate all these humans, ideally in a way that is in a livable environment, ideally in a way that doesn't eradicate all other species along the way, ideally in a way that creates the diverse and regenerative environments?
We can talk about your systems thinking at Vorha.
Well, the two are interrelated.
Everything is interrelated.
Everything is interrelated. That is a beautiful summary of it all, because systems thinking is talking about exactly that, the fact that everything is interrelated. So we cannot look at one particular aspect of the city and try to resolve it while neglecting or forgetting about all the other aspects that are there. Energy, green space, public space, traffic systems, all these systems are interrelated at the end of the day. In architecture or in urban planning, we're very much used to looking at certain aspects of the city or of the built environment. So we're very much used to looking at projects with regards to their plot ratio, for instance, with regards to their gross floor area that can be accommodated, height limitations, all these parameters, which ultimately can be form making, but also regulate the commercial aspect of architecture to a certain extent. And what we realize is that we need a set of new tools. We need to develop tools and measure aspects of architecture that are important to us. So we need to develop tools, for instance, for measuring green plot ratio. How much greenery can develop incorporate in relation to its overall plot size? Public space. How much public space can a development integrate? So the community plot ratio. Questions like the civic generosity index. So how much does a development give back to the city? What amenities does it provide? And this can go from cut-throughs through the building, allowing connections, passageways to street furniture. Yeah, what does it give back? What amenities can it provide? Ecosystem services, what kind of habitats can a development provide for biodiversity? So what we realize is that we really need to start evaluating the performance of our developments based on these kind of new tools, which urban planning is not necessarily used to. Another aspect where we think it really requires a different approach is in the distribution of the programs in the city. So the conventional way that cities are planned is very two-dimensional. In urban planning, you often speak about zoning. You have, you know, different parts of the city where people live, other parts where people work. You've got the central business district with high-rise office typologies. You've got, you know, industrial areas. In the 20th century, that has been the planning paradigm, and that has been a very kind of efficient way of organizing the city. But given that we're talking about higher and higher density and more people that we need to accommodate, we need to also see the shortfalls of this planning approach. And what we see in cities around us that grow very quickly, cities like Manila or Jakarta or Kuala Lumpur or Bangkok, what we see is that there are, of course, issues that come up with traffic, with congestion, with air pollution, and so on and so forth. So one really important aspect is cross-programming, or really three-dimensional planning. So rather than segregating different functions, we need to go into a three-dimensional planning approach where different programs can be layered vertically on top of each other. So to give you an example, maybe, and this works in different scales, so this works both on the building scale, but also on district scale. One example where this works in building scale is Kampung Admiralty. That is a mixed-use development where in different layers, different programs are accommodated. So you've got a public space on the ground floor with retail areas and a community space. You've got on the higher levels a hawker center, which is a food court typology. Above that, you have a medical center. Above that, a community park that is kind of really forming a green roofscape. And nestled in that green roofscape at the top layer is a housing component. So there are apartments accommodated there that are specifically designed for the elderly and for aging in place. Which means if I put myself into the shoes of someone living in this development, I can live on the 12th floor in my apartment. I can take the lift down and take a stroll in the community park. I can then grab a bite in the hawker center. I can walk past the retail on the ground floor, and I can stop over at the medical center on the way back up. So it's a whole different way of vertically moving through the building rather than having to, you know, every time go from point A, take private or public transport, go to the next stop and go about my business. We often refer to these projects as club sandwiches. So it's kind of, it's the layering of different programs. Every layer comes with its own, you know, flavor and nutrition rather than segregating this. And on a larger scale, we are implementing this, for instance, at the moment in PDD, the so-called Punggol Digital District here in Singapore, which is a project where we were involved from the very early stages of the master plan, and where this layered approach is really in the entire master plan. So PDD entails a university building, a business park, public transport, a bus interchange, community centers, hawker centers, retail areas. So it's really a little piece of city. You know, in a traditional city, what you would have is let's say you've got the university and you walk past the university buildings, maybe if you're lucky, it's a very green campus, that would be one part of the city. You would then walk to another part of the city where, you know, you have the shopping street. So you would have shops left and right. You would then walk to another part of the city where, you know, you accommodate another program. And rather than spreading this out, what PDD does is it stacks it vertically. So even on district scale, you have different layers that have different programs. The basement layer is kind of a service layer that houses the MRT station and a logistics center, district cooling systems, houses the entire traffic. So any car traffic goes directly underground so that then the natural ground layer is kept free for pedestrian traffic, for a huge network of community and public spaces. It contains an existing forest. And in the next layer above, kind of on a so-called elevated ground level, you have the actual university and business park that again has a collaboration loop, as we call it. So another circulation layer above. And then at the very top, there's another layer, which is kind of a productive layer, which is proposed to house a commercial farm and a photovoltaic roof. So that is really kind of showing the different systems that are addressed within the development and that can work both in a very small scale, but of course, even more so in a larger scale when you look at the district and the way that it performs.
Thinking about the big cities in Europe, would you think that this kind of vertical concept would also be adaptable over here? Because for us, being in Singapore and visiting such places, it's so surprisingly well working and it just feels so logic somehow. But in Europe, this is not a concept that can be found anywhere. So would you say that this might be a concept that can be adapted also for the European mega cities?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is, of course, that the pressure on European cities is not entirely comparable to the pressure on Asian cities and very fast-growing cities. Nonetheless, I would say that this is a global issue that we're dealing with. We're talking about the world population. We're not talking about one particular region that has to solve this. We're talking about a globe that needs to accommodate a huge human population. In some ways, I think the European cities have similar issues to tackle, which have to deal with density. We still need more housing in most European cities. We still need to densify the cities. And if the pressure on the population is not so extreme, and I remember from my time after graduation in Germany, I mean, we were talking about shrinking cities, right? We were talking about the question, how do we deal with regions in Germany where we have less and less people and where the infrastructure is struggling to keep up? And of course, while you're maybe not building mega cities and you're not building the same amount of gross floor area in European cities compared to Asian cities, the principles that we should pursue as we are looking at developing our cities further and bringing our cities into the 21st century are the same. And even if we are looking at a situation where the population doesn't grow, we should still consider, how do we accommodate them best? And the answer is not necessarily that you spread things out. The answer should be in compacting cities. We often see this as a problem. This is not necessarily a bad thing. So high density can mean high amenity and can mean diversity and can mean excitement. In this high density is where human culture and civilization can thrive, because this is where it can get exciting, where you get people from all walks of life coming together, rather than being, you know, separated, everyone on their own little land plot. So we don't need to see this necessarily as a problem. Even when we talk about, you know, areas that don't have such a massive population growth, we should still consider what is the right level of density. And even if that means that some part of the cities are renatured, and that's not a bad thing neither. We're at a point where actually sustainability alone is almost not enough anymore. we're already at a point where actually we need to talk about regeneration. We need to talk about fixing things that have already gone wrong and things that have already been broken. So the principles and the ideas, I think, are still very much applicable also in the European context. It may just translate to a different intervention in the respective context, but I think the principles are the same. Something that happened a couple of days ago, and I found it really fascinating. So I was taking part in a panel on the topic humanizing density. And of course, very interesting topic. And, you know, the question, how do you make high density livable? And, you know, how do you integrate amenity? How do you ensure it's not alienating? And there was one panel member who was not an architect and who was born and bred in Singapore. And he came to the topic with a completely honest and with a very genuine and personal approach. And his first reaction was, it never occurred to me that high density is dehumanizing. And I thought that was really interesting because I think in some ways we come with a very Western view of the topic. It is not a given. It is not a given that high density is by definition dehumanizing or bad. Obviously, there are issues in the cities that we urgently need to address, or not just in the cities, quite often really the issues that we need to address is what the city does to everything around it. So one thing is that the city itself has its complications, but in the way that the city consumes, and this is where the difference between, you know, sustainability and regeneration comes in, the way that the city consumes is unsustainable. So that becomes a task to be resolved. How do we feed these people and how do we accommodate these people without exploiting either the future or everything else around the city, right? Those are issues, but that's not inherently a problem of high density.
I would have one question. I remember a few years ago, I was able to visit you, not you personally, but your office in Singapore. And for me, it looked like kind of a livable research lab for all the things you're doing. Could you give us a small insight to get an idea of where you're really working? Like, what is your, you know, your surrounding context? Because I know there is a big garden on the roof. I remember you're like looking which plants can survive the best within Singapore, etc. So that would be something interesting to see, like what this micro situation helps to move into this macro architectural situation.
We would like to mention that we are huge fans of your studio.
Thank you.
If you haven't noticed yet.
I kind of like it here too. I think in some ways, we're really at a sweet spot of perfect testing conditions, right? And in some ways, Singapore in itself is a fantastic context to be working in. It's a very small system, right? As a city state, the decision-making process is really swift. The feedback loops are really, really fast. So for legislation and regulation to pick up on what is happening and what needs to be done and what people can do goes really, really quickly. So as one example, for instance, the development of the Green Mark scheme that evaluates environmental performance of architecture, that has evolved so quickly from originally a relatively blunt tool that really just ticked the boxes to by now a really highly sophisticated system that is still being developed further and further. So it's a constant push for innovation, a constant renewal, and a small enough system that really allows this to happen. So that as one aspect really makes practicing here very interesting. In the same time, what I mentioned earlier, that the tropical context, I think, is really also really, really interesting simply because we still need a lot of new typologies that work with this climate here, that work better with this climate than the typologies that were developed for the Western world. So that's another plus point. And then for us as an office, in some ways, I think there's a similar aspect with scale. So we're at a size where we're very comfortable. We're about 100 people. And we've been at that size for quite some time now. And this is where we're trying to stay. And funnily enough, it's actually because you mentioned the building and how we test different plants and so on. The building itself is also our yardstick whenever we don't fit into the building anymore. We know that we're too big and then we need to cut back a little bit. So it's a very kind of organic situation in some ways. And so I think we're at a scale where we're big enough to take on large projects and large assignments, but we're not that huge a machine that it becomes anonymous or that you don't know every project in the office anymore, or that you lose sight of projects and you lose quality control. So I think there's something about scale there as well. And it does mean that we can really test bed everything that we're suggesting. So from solar installations on the roof, where, you know, the first generation is already done, and now we're trying to think further, you know, what else can we do? Where else can we integrate more photovoltaic, to the integration of greenery, where we have both a farm on the roof, but we also have an internal courtyard that is naturally lit and where we can test different plant species at different height to see under what conditions which species thrive. And it has also led to a collaboration at the moment with a lighting supplier, because we realized there are not a lot of fantastic grow lights in the market. So for areas where you need to supplement the natural daylight with grow lights, we're developing a couple of new grow lights together with a lighting supplier that are really specifically providing the right wavelengths and are architecturally attractive. So yeah, it really is a test bed and a kind of a petri dish for everything that we try to implement. It becomes a way of life and work and thinking that is very holistic and has a lot of integrity in the sense that it's really all part of one at the end of the day. You know, it's not a cap that we put on Monday morning and then we take it off again Friday afternoon, but it really kind of reflects how we live and work and think.
We're approaching actually the end of our podcast. And as our listeners already know, we usually like to conclude by asking a personal question.
Okay.
Everyone is really excited to get to the end for the personal question.
Go for it.
You come from Germany/Europe and you've lived in Singapore since 2005. What do you miss about your home country?
Carnival. Well, my kids know when I get homesick, I watch an episode of the Tatort in Cologne. So, yes, there are certain kind of cultural nuances, you know, having people around you, friends and family who will understand all the fine grained nuances of your respective culture. But having said that, I am actually a mixed bag to begin with. So I'm of mixed cultural heritage. My father's Iranian and my mom's German. So I think I grew up with an appreciation for cultural diversity. And I always perceived that as a huge value, you know, to be able to experience diversity. And I have to say that Singapore is really pretty much unparalleled when it comes to that. Just the number of diverse cultures in all aspects that we're surrounded with is pretty amazing. But no, I do miss Carnival.
I understand that. Well, Shireen, thank you very, very much for your time. We will remember interrelating everything according to a club sandwich for our everyday lives and look forward to the next episode of our Jung Architecture Talks, the architecture podcast by Jung.